Okay, let's start. Good morning. Welcome to the press briefing of the UN Information Service here in Geneva. I would like to start immediately this press briefing with our guest from UNDP. But just before giving him the floor, just wanted to announce a last-minute press conference, press takeout. As you requested on Friday, we have been able to organize a stakeout today at 1 p.m. With the Undersecretary General of the United Nations and High Representative for Disarmament, Izumi Nakamitsu. She will be addressing you at the stakeout position in all 14 on the 22nd meeting of the state parties to the Convention on the Prohibition of the Use, Stockpiling, Production, and Transfer of Anti-Personnel Mines, and on their destruction. And we have sent you the speech of the Secretary General to the meeting yesterday. I just start with this so that you all know up front. And I'd like to thank Mrs. Nakamitsu, because that was really a request from the press corps, and she was happy to talk to you. So that will be at 1 p.m. at in all 14 at the stakeout position. The meeting, the stakeout will not be live, webcast live. It will be recorded, and then it will be made available on UN Web TV. Okay, so let's now go to UNDP. We have the pleasure to have with us the chief economist for UNDP Asia Pacific Regional Bureau, I'm calling in from Bangkok, and I've named Philip Schellekens, to whom I'm giving the floor now to tell us about AI. You're welcome, sir, please.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity. Greetings. Good morning. We just launched this morning a report in Bangkok called The Next Great Divergence, Why AI May Widen Inequality Between Countries. And we're actually here to sound an alarm. The world is risking to repeat the great divergence of the 19th century, where industrialization split the world into wealthy few and the impoverished many. But this time it's going to be driven by AI. That is our conjecture. Now, the narrative that you often hear is that AI can be a great equalizer, a tool for leapfrogging, and it can. AI can have a democratizing effect. It can help narrow gaps. But our analysis in this report, which came together as a collaboration of about a year between MIT in the US, Max Planck, and LSE, in Europe, and two Indian think tanks, APTI Institute and Digital Futures Lab, and two Chinese institutions, universities, Tsinghua University and University of Science and Technology in China. So crossing the geopolitical divides, we put this report together, and the analysis shows that without deliberative corrective action, AI is actually on track to be a great diverger, widening the gaps between nations. And I'd like to tell you a couple of things and provide a little bit of data to support this. So now this is a global message. We launched a report from Bangkok, but it's really a global message. But we'd like to illustrate it with a couple of numbers from the Asia Pacific region. Just to make the point, we're not starting from a level playing field. In this region, in Asia Pacific, the income gap between the richest and poorest country is 200-fold, that is between Singapore and Afghanistan. So this is the most unequal region in the whole world, according to this metric. And this is the fractured foundation upon which AI is landing. Second, innovation is hyper-concentrated. Just a few economies are accounting for most of actually global AI investment. China alone currently holds about 70% of global AI patents. And there is also a huge usage gap. In many low-income countries, fewer than one in five rural residents can use a basic spreadsheet. Yeah? So you can't build an AI economy if your workforce cannot use the digital basics. And then there is also a huge gender divide. The divergence has a female face. Women's jobs in the region are twice as exposed to automation than men's. And in South Asia alone, women are up to 40% less likely than men to even own a smartphone. Now, why does this matter? And now I'm going back from Asia to the world. developing nations around the world are facing a double whammy. And this sort of inequality is manifesting itself in two ways. First of all, in a capability gap. So we are concerned that the gains of AI will arrive much faster in countries equipped to harness them, and these are the richer countries. These are the countries with stronger digital foundations, skilled talent, agile regulation. They could realize estimated annual productivity gains of 5% in sectors like finance and health. But countries with limited connectivity and weak governance risk missing most of this upside. So there's a lesser ability for the poorer countries to participate in the gains from AI. And secondly, there's also, in addition to the capability gap, there's a vulnerability gap. The disruptions will strike the hardest where resilience is the lowest. And these disruptions will be real. We already see right now that 3 in 4 firms around the world are expecting job losses due to automation, alongside also jobs being created. By 2030, we also see another type of disruption, which is that AI data centers will double their water use and triple their electricity use. And this is creating massive resource stress for countries that are already climate vulnerable. So even where the exposure varies, poorer countries tend to lack the fiscal buffers and the safety nets to withstand the threats ranging from these disruptions, going from outsourcing jobs to deepfakes, destabilizing fragile institutions. So these two gaps, the capability gap and vulnerability gap, are, in our view, two drivers of greater inequality between countries in the future. But this is not inevitable, and I'd like to conclude with three quick points on what can be done about this. First of all, we need to think beyond hard infrastructure. Let us stop thinking that dropping in a technology solves development. We learned this the hard way with the one laptop per child initiative, where we were giving a child a device without a teacher or a lesson plan, and realized that this often leads to the device simply gathering dust. And the same risk really applies to AI. Hardware alone does not ensure usage. If we invest in data centers, but we fail to train teachers, we fail to support local curricula, or we integrate these tools wrongly into a local context, we're just building digital white elephants. So we also need that soft infrastructure, the skills and the institutions that make the technology actually work for people. And the second point on policies is that regional cooperation, the small economies cannot build sovereign AI alone. You know, if every country tries to build its own infrastructure from scratch, the poorest will fail. We need regional and global public goods. We need shared data centers and pooled computational power. This will allow countries to share the cost while maintaining sovereign partitions for their data. This is the only way to ensure that smaller nations aren't locked into opaque black box systems owned entirely by foreign tech giants. And then finally, tailored roadmaps. We need to stop using single templates for AI development. A strategy for Singapore will not work in Papua New Guinea. And our report, and that's, I think, the distinguishing feature of this report, is it outlines differentiated policy recommendations according to starting conditions, according to capacity levels, according to timelines, and also according to sectors. And just to give you a couple of examples, for lower capacity settings like Cambodia or Papua New Guinea and several other countries around the world, the goal isn't really to build that next frontier model. It is simply to prioritize offline capable AI, like simple voice-based tools for frontline health workers and farmers that work even when the internet is down. For transition economies like Indonesia or Vietnam, the focus is really on scaling. You know, these countries have the basics. Now they need to move from pilot projects to system-wide adoption, and also rigorously avoiding vendor lock-in so they don't become dependent on a single provider. So these are the key messages from our report. We think that AI is heralding a new era of rising inequality between countries, following actually years of convergence in the last 50 years. But that convergence was really selective. Not many countries and not many regions participated in it. Latin America, for example, for the last 100 years has been at roughly 25% of the per capita income of the US, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. Sub-Saharan Africa has continued to slide down over the last 70 years. Only in South Asia, only recently, South Asia started to converge. It's only in a couple of regions, and within those regions, only a couple of countries, we saw that convergence happening. So divergence has been the dominant feature of history. And we would really like that to turn it around, that AI is going to contribute to the narrowing of inequality between countries rather than those centrifugal forces dominating the potential of the democratizing effects and leapfrogging effects of AI. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Philip, for this interesting presentation of your report. I'll open the floor to questions now, if any. I don't see any in the room. Let me see on the platform. John Zarokostas, France 24.
Yes, good morning. Can you hear me there?
Yeah, we can. Go ahead, John.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for this update on your report. It would have been nice if the Geneva Press Corps received one as well. My question is, in your research, did you examine the impact of artificial intelligence in warfare and especially increase in the use of artificial intelligence in civil wars and conflicts like we've seen recently in Sudan, in Ukraine, in Gaza? And today it's World Disability Day. How much are they contributing to heavy casualties in war zones? Thank you.
Not that much, but we did cover that in a limited way, in the sense that, as you know, in the policy part of the report, we argue that the deployment of AI should be grounded in value-based principles. And we do need to govern AI responsibly. So there's a whole part of the report that goes into depth on that. And there we do examine the role of AI in warfare and for military applications and the importance of strict oversight in view of the risks, whereas other applications obviously can attract lower levels of oversight and where we can allow AI to flourish. But you are alluding to something that is a very prevalent feature of the discussion on AI right now. There is on the one hand a sense that AI presents an existential opportunity, yeah, for humankind to solve existential threats like climate change, advanced medical research, to be even faster in pandemics. But quite clearly, there is also a very dark side to this, and where AI in itself poses an existential threat and can be a negative force for humanity. And I think the issues that you mentioned regarding military applications are certainly areas of concern where AI could provoke mass casualties. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I see that Sarah wants to add something.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much, Philip, for the presentation. And John, I've seen the press release and the summary of a report on Friday, so it might have ended up in your spam. For those of you who want the full report or wants me to reshare the press release, just send me a message and I'll follow up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sarah. Jamie Keaton, Associated Press.
Hi, can you hear me? Yeah, this is Jamie from Associated Press. Thank you. Mr. Shelkins, I appreciate your presentation. You mentioned at the outset that there's a sort of a divergence in developing countries that run the risk of being left behind by AI. Obviously, a lot of the development for artificial intelligence is being done in developed countries. So how do you convince those countries and those companies that are doing this work that they have an interest in seeing developing countries also take part? Because at the end of the day, they're just I mean, from, you know, you're somebody who used to work for the World Bank, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, you understand what it's like for these richer countries. They need to see some sort of interest if they want to try to see a need for that to be shared, the technologies to be shared. So how do you convince them that that they should be sharing the knowledge, so to speak, in this space?
Well, I think there's a stick and a carrot, right? The carrot would be it's in everybody's interest for developing countries to do well. And we have seen the global center of economic gravity shifting eastward and southward. And for example, 80% of global middle class growth between now and the end of this decade will come from Asia and the Pacific, mostly from South Asia, and also the deepening of the middle class in China and elsewhere, and Indonesia will continue to contribute that. So it's clearly in the interest of everyone if the pie of global economic activity continues to grow, and then through trade and other linkages, we can all benefit from that. I know that's not an appealing message, perhaps, in today's climate of geopolitical tensions and receding interest in multilateralism, but that is still the fact. We have benefited, broadly speaking, from the era of globalization. AI could continue contributing that to the extent that AI will bring efficiency gains. The middle classes will gain real incomes and will demand more goods and services from everywhere around the world. So that is a clear benefit. But there's also the stick approach. To the extent that this, if this great divergence is really going to happen, and we hope actually our recommendations will become obsolete and the messages of this report will become entirely wrong if they are going to be followed, the great divergence will not happen. But if it does happen and we do see a further widening and a lack of progress, not necessarily a receding of progress, we don't necessarily need to see a decline in the prosperity of, for example, Africans or in Latin America or other parts of the world. But if in relative terms, those inequalities around the world keep on widening, it is going to be unsustainable. And in today's world, what is now fundamentally different compared to previous eras where new technologies were rolled out, is that the world today is much more connected. So if inequality continues to rise, the spillover effects of that in terms of the security agenda, in terms of undocumented forms of migration, will also become more daunting. So that will be my response. There's both a stick and a carrot. And finally, I think everybody will benefit from competition in the innovation space. We are in uncharted territory. There are new applications of AI being developed. Developing countries can benefit from the innovations in rich countries, but conversely, richer countries can also learn from the innovations in the poorer countries. For example, even in a country as poor as Papua New Guinea, AI is being used to monitor biodiversity. In Fiji, AI is being used to predict cyclones, lessons that could be exported to other parts of the world. Thank you.
Up, John.
Yes, hello. It's John once again. Yes, Sarah, indeed, it had gone into the spam. I've got a follow-up question, sir. In your press release, you mentioned 70% of the AI patents are being held by Chinese companies. Is that correct? And which are the six economies where these patents are being held, the majority of them?
Okay, let me go to my notes. Just one second. You need to give me a little bit of time here. Would you mind if I get back to you in writing on that, and perhaps I can respond to any other question while I'm for that information.
Yeah, but take your time, Philippe. There are no other questions, but I'm sure that through Sarah or directly, you can send these numbers to John. Thank you very much. This was your last question for you. So thanks again for briefing us on the report. And yes, please, Sarah will do the follow-up. And now let me go to my left, thanks again, Philippe, where I have Eugene with us from UNHCR. Eugene, you brought Xavier Crick, who is the UNHCR representative in Mozambique. There are a very important number of displaced people because of the violences there. You want to introduce your colleague?
Absolutely. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining today's briefing. Just to open this briefing, last December, UNHCR briefed about the devastating consequences of a cyclone Chido, if you remember, which brought the widespread destruction and also forced the family flee from their home. This December, unfortunately, we are facing another wave of displacement caused by intensifying violence, which is a very important reminder that what Mozambique people, like people from Mozambique, is suffering at the moment. So we are glad to bring Xavier, our representative in Mozambique, who is actually on the way from Nampula. He just finished his mission in Nampula, in Erati. So he's on the way going back. So welcome, Xavier. Thank you so much.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning, June. I'm still in Erati, in northern Mozambique. And as just said, where 100,000 persons have arrived over the last 2 weeks only. They all come from the district of Memba, which is a neighboring district in the province of Nampula. They have faced several multiple attacks from armed groups. They have seen attacks at night, their home being burned. Many civilians have been killed, some even beheaded. They had to flee, as you can imagine, in a very chaotic manner through the bush. Many children got separated from their parents whilst fleeing and have followed whichever adult they could to arrive here to Erati. You have to remember that it's close to 1.3 million persons who have been displaced in Mozambique since the beginning of the conflicts in 2017. But regretfully, we have seen in the last 3-4 months a real, very worrying intensification of the conflict with multiple simultaneous attacks hitting different districts at the same time. As a result, the collective response, I would even call about the collective efforts of all of us, humanitarian actors, UN agencies, NGOs, community-based organizations, but also the authorities, the governor of Nampula is here, as well as the private sector. Despite our collective efforts, the response is largely insufficient. We are unable to meet the needs of the people. Humanitarian assistance is missing. People are sleeping in overcrowded community centers, schools. Many, many remain sleeping outside under a tree. The rainy season has started, and I would say most needs remain very challenging to meet in terms of wash, food, of course. And all this give rise to increasing number of production concerns. People had to flee under very difficult circumstances, so most of them don't have their documents with them. So it makes much more difficult access to services. But I would add to that that these overcrowded classroom and community centers expose children, women, girls to very serious form of gender-based violence. Every day, we have more and more cases. In the morning, women coming to see us explaining the sexual abuse. They have been victims during the day, or during the night, rather. And same thing, these unmet needs made the IDP population exposed to various forms of abuse and exploitation here, extremely vulnerable people. So it was very sad today, this morning, to see some people deciding to return to very unsafe areas because the response was not able to meet their needs. So they made the very difficult decision to go back this morning. So I'm really here calling for support, a very significant increased support for all humanitarian actors to support the authorities in order to meet the need and to offer the people the protection they deserve. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Xavier. Let me see if there are questions for you in the room. Alexandre, AFP.
Yeah. Thank you for taking my questions. For everybody, maybe it's better in English now. Two questions, please. You're talking about 1.3 million displaced since the beginning of the conflict, and you're talking about the surge those last 3 months. Do you have a figure of the number of displaced people those last 3 months? And the other questions concern the number of people who had to return to unsafe places. Do you have an estimation of the number of those people, please?
Okay, good morning, Alexandre. Thanks for the question. So the number of figures over the last 3 months is a minimum of 287,000. But I would say this figure is only the people who have been registered and who have gone to IDP sites. Many more have gone to some families, have not been identified, other fled towards urban centers. And last but not least, some are still hidden in the bush. So I think we can talk approximately of a minimum of 300,000 displaced over the, since July. So July must be a bit more than 3 months, must be 4 or 5 months. Sorry, I'm under a tree. And there is a, now people who have returned this morning, so it's approximately, I would say 200 to 300 people who have returned this morning. It's the first time we see this movement here. So very difficult to say how long it will last. But what is the most difficult for us to hear is why do they return? They don't return because they feel safety is waiting for them at home, or they don't return because they can. They feel they return their life. They return because they lack assistance, they lack support. They have been there on the different side for 2 weeks. And us humanitarian actors, despite really lots of effort, collective effort, again, I want to mention the provincial authorities and the help of some private companies to provide food. We have not been able to meet their needs. And many are, I mean, many, some have started to return home. What I should say is that we also have people crossing, because while some are returning this morning, we still see people arriving and telling us about new attacks.
Thank you very much. Other questions to Xavier? Let me look at the platform. I don't see any hand up. So thank you very much to both Eugene and Xavier from Nampula. And yeah, thanks a lot. Thanks. And good luck with your important
thank
work,
you.
Xavier. Thank you. Claire, Ricardo, please. Can you come to the podium? So we have all seen in the news the terrible images of the flooding in Asia, and we've got Claire to tell us a little bit more about the meteorological aspects of this terrible flooding, but also Ricardo, that I think was not on our list, but has now numbers on how the flooding have been affecting children in Asia. So I don't know who wants to start.
I can give you.
Okay,
thanks. Yes, good morning, everybody. Glad to be here. I'm going to give an overview of what's been happening across parts of Asia and Southeast Asia, and then I think my UNICEF colleague will focus more on Sri Lanka. Devastating rainfall has triggered catastrophic flooding in a number of countries across South and Southeast Asia, as we're seeing on the news. Hundreds of people have died, entire communities have been displaced, and there's massive, massive economic and agricultural disruption. National Meteorological and Hydrological Services obviously are working around the clock. They will continue to work around the clock to provide forecasts, warnings to inform government decision-making, and we at the World Meteorological Organization, we have what we call the WMO coordination mechanism. That is a mechanism which provides weather and climate information to the humanitarian sector. So they've been very, very busy in the past couple of weeks providing weekly hydromet scans, which have been warning of these terrible high impact events, and also more detailed long-term climate analyses. Excuse me. Indonesia, the Philippines, Sri Lanka, Thailand, and Vietnam are among the countries currently most affected. We saw other countries in Asia which were affected earlier on this year. It's a combination of monsoon-related rainfall and tropical cyclone activity. Asia is very, very vulnerable to floods. Every year, WMO produces a State of the Climate in Asia report, and floods is consistently one of the top hazards. And as we know, rising temperatures increase the potential risk of more extreme rainfall events because a warmer atmosphere holds more moisture. That's the law of physics. So we are seeing more extreme rainfall, and we will continue to do so in the future. The latest disasters underline the importance of greater regional cooperation. That's obviously one of the main focuses of WMO's work. We work very, very closely to strengthen regional mechanisms to forecast events ahead of time and to help the coping capacity. And in fact, today, as we're speaking here, the Typhoon Committee is meeting in China. It's a different part of the world. It's a different basin. But again, you know, the principle is the same. We need stronger regional cooperation. We need more data sharing. WMO Secretary General Celeste Saulo said in a video message to this meeting, the Asia-Pacific region faces the most intense and frequent tropical cyclone activity in the world. Record-breaking rainfall, storm surges, and floods displace millions and call billions of dollars in economic losses. No single institution or country can tackle the challenges of tropical cyclones or climate extremes alone. We've sent out the briefing note, and that gives detail. So it goes into great detail of the types of products that we have been providing to the humanitarian sector: the hydromet scans, the seasonal outlooks. Just quickly to run through the impacts, and again, you've got all the details of this in the briefing note. Starting with Indonesia. Tropical cyclone Senyar brought torrential rainfall and widespread flooding and landslides across northern Sumatra in Indonesia, peninsular Malaysia, and southern Thailand. Tropical cyclones are rare so close to the equator, so it's not something that we see very often, and it means the impacts are magnified because local communities, you know, have got no experience in this. According to the official Indonesian National Disaster Office, and this is the emergency dashboard as updated today, there are 604 fatalities, 464 missing people, and 2,600 people are injured, with 1.5 million people affected and more than 570,000 displaced. So this is huge. Vietnam is bracing for yet more heavy rainfall. Vietnam has been battered now for weeks, relentless rainfall. Vietnam is bracing for yet more heavy rainfall for its south central region today. This is under the impacts of a storm, Storm Koto, which earlier hit the Philippines. Exceptional rains in the past few weeks have flooded historic sites, popular tourist resorts, and caused massive damages. In the briefing notes, we've given some of the figures of the rainfall. It's absolutely huge. You know, some locations have exceeded more than 1,000 millimeters of rainfall, which is very, very big in meteorological terms. There's big flooding. Casualties, and this is the statistics we got overnight from the Vietnamese Meteorological Department, 108 human casualties, including 98 deaths and 10 missing. So that's just in the last 2 weeks of October alone. earlier on in late October. This is just to give you an idea of how long this rainfall has been going on. One meteorological station in central Vietnam recorded a national 24-hour rainfall record of 1,739 millimeters. That's really, really enormous. It's the second highest known total anywhere in the world for a 24-hour rainfall. To move on to the Philippines. The Philippines is recovering from back-to-back typhoons in early November. And the Philippines is regularly hit by tropical cyclones, and it's, you know, still recovering from unprecedented cyclones in 2024. And so now we've got, you know, this additional impact. And Sri Lanka, which we will hear more about shortly, nearly 1 million people are affected, and more than 400 reported dead or missing after cyclonic storm Ditwa unleashed record flooding and landslides across Sri Lanka. Again, it's a rare tropical cyclone. The path was unusual. It tracked directly down Sri Lanka's east coast, which is, you know, it's not a usual track, and it made landfall on the 27th of November. The WMO's Regional Specialized Meteorological Center in New Delhi did provide advance warnings of the track and of the landfall, and without these warnings, terrible as the casualties are, the toll probably would have been even higher. Obviously, the Sri Lankan government has declared a national disaster. This country, you know, has not seen anything like this for many, many years. And our thoughts and condolences are with everybody affected. So that will do for me. It's quite long, but we've sent out the briefing notes, which have got all the details. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Claire. Ricardo, particularly on Sri Lanka.
Yes, thank you, Alessandra. Cyclone Ditwa made landfall on the east coast in Sri Lanka, impacting over 275,000 children, who are amongst the over 1.4 million people affected across Sri Lanka. And with communications down and roads blocked, the true number of children impacted is likely even higher. Homes have been swept away, entire communities isolated, and the essential services children rely on, such as water, healthcare, and schooling, have been severely disrupted. For hundreds of thousands of girls and boys, this is now a fast-moving humanitarian emergency. Widespread displacement has forced families into unsafe, overcrowded shelters. Flooding and damaged water systems are heightening the risk of disease outbreaks, while the loss of food stocks and disrupted supply chains are raising concerns about malnutrition, particularly for young children. Many have experienced terrifying conditions and the loss of homes or loved ones, leaving them at increased risk of severe emotional distress. UNICEF is working around the clock with the government and partners to assess the full scale of needs and deliver life-saving assistance, from clean drinking water and essential nutrition supplies to psychosocial support and emergency educational kits. But the needs far outweigh the available resources right now. As Sri Lanka's most vulnerable communities continue to reel from successive shocks and rising poverty, additional funding and sustained support are urgently required to reach the most affected children and ensure their safety, health, and dignity in the weeks ahead. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks. Let me see in the room if there's any hand up. No? Alicia, online, FA.
Hello, thank you for taking my question. It's for Claire Mullis. I wanted to know if the meteorological services from these countries knew in advance that this was going to happen, or were conscious of the scale and were prevented. Thank you.
As far as I know, yes, the meteorological services and also the national meteorological services and the regional mechanisms. You know, we do, as I've said, we have very strong regional mechanisms. These events were forecast ahead of time. So in the case of the tropical cyclone that hit Sri Lanka, the India Meteorological Department acts as WMO's regional meteorological center in the Bay of Bengal for tropical cyclones. And they did forecast quite accurately the track. Volume of rainfall is more difficult to predict in advance. But again, you know, the warnings, as far as I know, were there. WMO, we have, in addition to all our other mechanisms, we also have a flash flood guidance program, and that does give, you know, guidance on where we're expecting the worst flash floods to be. And, you know, this is operational in most of these countries. There are big gaps. You know, there are big gaps in warning and forecasting capacity. And as you may know, the World Meteorological Organization, we are spearheading, co-spearheading the Early Warnings for All initiative. This was launched by the UN Secretary General 3 years ago to ensure that everybody is covered by early warnings. And one of the emphases of this initiative, which is joint with the UN Office for Disaster Risk Reduction, the ITU and the IFRC, is to make sure that the forecasts and the early warnings, they reach the people on the ground. You know, so there's no point in having a forecast if it doesn't reach the person on the ground. But I think what I would say is that, you know, in the case of Vietnam, the rainfall has been absolutely relentless. So even if you do have forecasts and early warnings, which are being provided, you know, what can you do when you've just got that sheer volume of rainfall and falling for so long? The case of Sri Lanka, as I said, the track of the tropical cyclone was quite rare. And the case of Indonesia, again, the path of this tropical cyclone was quite unusual. So it's hitting communities which, you know, which don't have much experience and don't necessarily have the infrastructure to withstand these types of storms.
Thank you very much. No other hands. I can't see any.
Before I go, yes, can please. I just a couple of brief announcements, sure, which I forgot. So on Thursday morning, WMO will be issuing the La Nina update. La Nina, the El Nino La Nina update. As we know, that does have an impact on climate patterns around the world. So that is coming out on Thursday. We hope to send it to you tomorrow under embargo. Also on Thursday, we are releasing the State of the Climate Report for 2024 for the Arab region. So it's got a very, you know, specific focus on what happened in the climate last year in the Arab region. Again, that will be sent to you under embargo tomorrow. We have it available in English and in Arabic. Thank you.
Thank you, Claire. Still no hands up, so thank you very much. David, our last but not least speaker of the morning, you have an announcement also about ITU.
Thank you, Ali. Yes, a quick announcement that members of ITU from government, industry, academia will meet at ITU headquarters for the first interregional information session on WRC 27 preparations. That begins tomorrow, Wednesday, the 3rd, through and extends through the Friday, the 5th of December, to consider the latest technical and regulatory studies in radio spectrum management and review regional preparations for the World Radio Communication Conference, WRC 27. IRIS is part of the overall WRC preparatory process, including extensive studies and discussions among WRC participants. WRC is held every 4 years to update ITU's radio regulations, which is the sole international treaty governing the use of radio frequency spectrum. and the allocation of satellite orbits. WRC 27 will take place in Shanghai, China from 18 October and 12 November 2027, preceded by the Radio Communication Assembly from 11 through 15 October. While technical in nature, the three-day information center that we call IRIS is open to reporters. You can send a note to PressReg at ITUINT if you intend to cover physically. Also, a public webcast is also available.
Thank you very much. Any question? That was it's an end? No? Okay. Thanks a lot. Let me just see if we have any question online. No? So thanks again for this announcement, David. I have a few on my own. Just to remind everyone that in very, very little time, in 1 hour and a half, at 1 o'clock, please be in the Hall 14 for the press conference that you have requested to Mrs. Nakamitsu, our USG, for and her representative for disarmament. She will speak briefly about the 22nd meeting of the state parties to the Convention on the Prohibition of the Use, Stockpiling, Production, and Transfer of Anti-Personnel Mines and on their destructions, which is taking place at the moment in Assembly Hall. And she will take questions, so please be there at 1 p.m. Also, on the same in the same framework of the same meeting, I remind you that tomorrow at 11 a.m. you're going to have four heads of mine action programs of UNMAS in Afghanistan, Sudan, Nigeria, and OPT. They will talk to you from this room at 11 a.m. on protecting people from mines and other explosive ordnance in complex settings. A reminder that Thursday, 4 December at 10 a.m., you will be able to be here in this room with the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Türk, who will give you his end-of-year press conference. And finally, Friday, 5th of December, at 9:30 before the briefing, there will be a press conference of the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, which will announce the findings on Burundi, Guatemala, Maldives, New Zealand, Sweden, and Tunisia. And this, of course, is going to be there our last week. Also, this committee on Thursday, for a full day, they will celebrate the 60th anniversary of the convention, which has been adopted on the 21st December 1965, with a meeting at Palais Wilson. The Committee on the Protection of the Rights of All Migrant Workers and Members of Their Families is beginning this morning the review of the report of Indonesia, and will conclude this afternoon the review of the report on Mauritania. The other countries to be examined is Honduras. And on Friday, 5th of December, from 4 to 6, the committee will also have a public meeting for the launching of the Joint General Recommendation on Eradicating Xenophobia Towards Migrants and Others Perceived as Such. I also wanted to inform you, so I've told you all this, yes, that pursuing the adoption of the General Assembly Resolution 47-3, proclaiming 3rd December as the International Day of Persons with Disabilities, as we have said before, we will be at UNOG, we will be organizing a series of events in partnership with other international organizations and permanent missions. That will be from the 8th to the 10th of December to celebrate both this International Day and Human Rights Day that, as you know, falls on the 10th of December. The theme of this series of events will be inclusion and progress. So on Monday, 8th of December at 12:30 p.m., there will be an online webinar on Alzheimer's disease. It will be held by Professor Giovanni Frisoni. And the webinar will offer the participants the opportunity to learn about the latest scientific advances on dementia and innovative approaches to prevent cognitive decline. On Tuesday, 9th December, the Palais des Nations will host a screening of The Color of Autism, a 2024 documentary by Swiss filmmaker Michel Beuchat that offers a sensitive and authentic look at autism. and the projection will be followed by an informal exchange with participants on the film's key messages. This is organized in partnership with OCHA. Wednesday, 10th of December, we'll see a lot of children coming to the Palais from public schools, and children of UN official media are also invited to join. They will be able to visit the Human Rights Council and will share reflections and drawings on inclusion and accessibility. That is organized in partnership with the Permanent Mission of Mexico, with the permanent, with the support of the Permanent Mission of Finland and New Zealand and WIPO. So I hope you will be able to participate or cover this series of events. And this is what I had for you in terms of announcements. If there are no other questions, I don't see any hand up. Thank you all very much, and I'll see you at 1 p.m. in the Hall 14 for the stakeout of USG Nakamitsu. Thank you.